You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, sponsored by Indeed. If you're in charge of recruitment for your company, Indeed Sponsored Jobs is exactly what you need. It can help you hire the right person for the job, someone with the right skills, background and experience to really drive your business forward, matching the candidates to the skills that you're looking for. Indeed Sponsored Jobs will give you an advantage right from the start, elevating your job ad above the rest and enabling you to attract a wide array of quality candidates who really match the experience and skills that you're looking for. If you are hiring a sprinter for a cycling team, you'd want to sift through and eliminate the climbers and time trialists for that particular role. And the principle is very much the same no matter what organisation you're hiring for. And Indeed Sponsored Jobs can make the process of recruitment quicker, more seamless, and give you better results. So spend more time interviewing candidates who check all of your boxes with less stress and better results with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. Listeners to the Cycling Podcast will get a £100 sponsored job credit to help get your job the premium status it deserves. Go to indeed.com/cycle. Just go to indeed.com/cycle right now and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on the Cycling Podcast. That's indeed.com/cycle. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed. Now it's on with the Cycling Podcast.
Hello and welcoming you on January the 29th after a week in cycling when a Joey wreaked havoc at the Tour Down Under but didn't spoil Jay's happy homecoming and Jonas Vingegaard crash in the south of Spain began a debate about how Joe Public should share or maybe concede the road to the stars of the international peloton. My name is Daniel Freeman. I'm the host of this episode of the Cycling Podcast, which we will discuss all of that and other latest news from the world on two wheels, sharing the figurative tarmac with me today in exemplary, unobtrusive fashion, I hope at least, is a man who I'm sure has never harassed or hurried even a professional athlete on or off the bike. It's Lionel Burney.
More off the bike, possibly back in the dim and distant.
Harassed or hurried or heckled?
Heckled, pop. Yes, maybe.
Probably, at least internally.
Well, I've mellowed a lot. I've mellowed a lot with age.
Have you? Also returning today is the only man ever to spend 6 weeks in Australia and come back with a brand new accent. That accent we've never heard before, Rob Hatch, is a Lancastrian one. I've heard a few of your recordings recently and I've never heard, it's all, I can barely understand you.
Hey, guy, mate, what are you on about?
Oh, dear.
We're going to hear later in the episode, we're going to hear you in conversation briefly, in conversation with Matt Winston, who's the director sportif.
I've missed you too, by the way.
Firmenich. And you both, I'm not going to accuse Matt of hamming it up when you're together, but you certainly do. You certainly do. I need subtitles. When you two get together, two Lancastrians. Anyway, Rob, you're back having exchanged the sunshine of Australia for the mire of Mallorca, the pretty horrible weather, judging by what we saw earlier, the Challenge Mallorca.
Yeah, it's been absolutely awful. It's 45 degrees when I left Adelaide on Monday, and I've been told by friends at home to put the heating on, and I was sort of laughing at them, saying, come on. But yeah, it's been pretty miserable since I got back. So it's been a return to winter after 6 weeks of summer.
We'll be talking about your trip in some fashion. We'll be concentrating more on the cycling that occurred in Australia rather than what you have been getting up to in Australia. But who knows, we might touch on that as well. Chaps, a bit of a disclaimer. We're going to issue this disclaimer straight away because I have already referred to kangaroos in this episode. That was the Joey in the intro. We shouldn't be too flippant about this because at the Tour Down Under, there was a collision with a kangaroo, some local wildlife on, was it the last stage, chaps? It was last stage, wasn't it? Well, as I said, we're not going to be too flippant because it was a very unfortunate crash because the kangaroo in question was so badly injured that it had to be put down, I believe. So no more kangaroo jokes, certainly. The other thing I mentioned, chaps, that's caused a lot of debate in the news over the last week, and we'll talk about in some detail, is this Jonas Vingegaard incident, a crash in the south of Spain in training. Now, before we get on to that, chaps, before we move on to the real, the important business in the episode, got me thinking about encounters, your encounters with professional cyclists when you have been riding yourselves. Have there been any? I think I've talked about a couple on the podcast before. One in about circa 2000, I was working for MAPE, the company. I was fully clad in MAPE kit and I was riding somewhere near Lake Como up a little, it was a little sort of false flat, broke my chain, ripped my derailleur off my bike. I was stranded at the side of the road in the middle of nowhere. Stefano Gardelli, also wearing full MAPE kit because he was a MAPE rider, rode past and completely blanked me, left me completely stranded. So that was one. He went on the list after that, needless to say.
Which list was that? He's been on a few lists.
Well, the following year, he got booted out of the Giro d'Italia when he was in the pink jersey. And Mappe's claim, the conspiracy theory, was that his orange juice had been contaminated. I can't confirm or comment on whether I had any hand in that. The other one was in 1998, I was working in Switzerland. And I was riding to Decathlon to buy my first ever clipless pedals. And I happened upon Richard Virenque, who'd just been kicked out of the Tour de France a couple of months earlier. And he lived in Geneva with Laurent Jalabert, another French rider who lived in Geneva. And I was so excited, I stopped at a phone box to call my parents, neither of whom gave it a single shit about professional cycling. that's how excited I was on that occasion. Anyway, those were my two.
I've missed you two anyway, dearie me.
I was going to say, hang on, clipless pedals adopted in 1998. You're some kind of Luddite, late adopting Luddite.
Well, I'd only been cycling for a couple of years.
Oh, I mean, even later than Sean Kelly.
You were 35 in 1998, right? I was only a teenager.
The only two that come to mind for me are Sean Kelly led me out for a sprint in the Bois de Boulogne in the sort of Wednesday evening chain gang. I didn't dare tell him.
It doesn't count if you actually went cycling with the person.
Oh, okay.
We're talking about chance encounters.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Well, Bjarne Riis overtook me very slowly on Alpe d'Huez and he had a team car behind him, which I don't know. I've never asked Brian this. Brian Nygaard, whether Brian was driving that team car when he was back in the day as the head of communications at the CSC team. It was on a Tour de France rest day. I can't remember which year. I was struggling on Alpe d'Huez and Bjarne Riis was struggling ever so slightly less than me and sort of came past me in a sort of comedy, slow motion overtaking move. And the car seemed to take a long, long time to get past me. And I was in a sort of cloud of diesel fumes for longer than was pleasant on Alpe d'Huez. Very hot day.
It's
well,
a cloud of self-loathing, man.
Well, that was, you know, that's a, you know, goes without saying.
Hatch?
It's sort of cheating a bit being out here, isn't it? Because it happens quite often. The last one was with track world champion now, Albert Torres. And I was swinging up Puig Mayor sometime in autumn. He was coming down the other side doing a training ride. And we clocked each other because he does live just down the road. And he could see I was struggling so bad. It was one of those hot days. He gave me about 6 energy gels. I was sort of thinking of turning back at the top of the hill and coming down again. Oh, I've sort of done my work. I'm not feeling so good today. But now I had that in my back pocket. I sort of felt obliged to continue on over the top, past the reservoirs, and do the full sort of 100K loop because he sort of guilt tripped me into continuing on. But yeah, I mean, a few years ago, I remember sort of when Primoz Roglic came on the scene, he used to seem to go past him every single day. He loved training out here, but he obviously always be going the other way and always be going very, very fast. So didn't get too much of a good look at early Primoz.
And never gave you a single gel.
No, he didn't. Poor effort.
Shame on Primoz.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
This episode of the Cycling Podcast is brought to you by BICMO Cycle Insurance because let's face it, things happen. Whether it's a crash landing, the heartbreak of a stolen bike, or the ultimate facepalm moment of reversing over your prized aero wheel, BICMO has you covered. Flexible policies that you can cancel anytime, 50% off extra bikes in your household, protection for your kit, race entries, and even damage while travelling to your next epic ride. They've thought of it all. And here's the thing, BICMO isn't some faceless insurance company. They're all bike riders too, with a shared mission to protect the world's riders and the places we ride. So when you insure with them, you're not just getting great coverage, you're joining a community that gets what it means to love cycling. So whether you're smashing sprints, grinding climbs, or just enjoying a Sunday spin, ride safe. BICMO's got your back. Protect your ride before it's too late. Head to bikmo.com to get covered. That's BIKMO.com. Flexible policies. Cancel any time. Terms apply. Check your policy docs.
Well, chaps, before the break, we started talking about Jonas Vingegaard's... it's not really an altercation with a fan, was it? But certainly crossing paths with a gentleman who... whose name was so stereotypically Spanish, I wondered whether he'd actually been made up. We will talk more about that later. However, etiquette when coming across professional riders when they're out on their training routes. But we will, before that, talk about some of the racing that's already happened in this 2026 season. The first World Tour race of the season happened last week. It finished at the weekend, and Rob... you were there, not in a professional capacity, not in a strictly professional capacity, I think I'm right in saying.
No, it was a bit of a holiday tacked on the end of my Ashes experience out there. I went to see family over in WA in Perth straight after Sydney Test. And then I was looking at the schedule thinking, well, I don't
Rob's
normally...
talking about cricket.
Sorry,
international for listeners. The Ashes.
Transatlantic listeners, I guess, no? Although I did have a few Americans come up and talk to him about cricket, bizarrely, at the Tour Down Under. But yeah, I decided to go see some family after the last cricket match in Sydney. And I realised that I don't normally start commentating until Mallorca starts. And I realised I can fit another week holiday in. And curiously enough, the Tour Down Under was on a Myra ticket. My return ticket was from Adelaide, where I'd started my Australian experience. So it was a perfect fit, and I had a nice week just catching up with people at races, because I'm sure many of you know now, we don't do too much of the commentary, if any, really, from the races finish lines anymore. So it was very nice to go and see a few people I hadn't seen for a while. And I took in a few stages while I was there as well. And I'm really, really impressed with the organisation of the race.
Let's not dwell on the Ashes. From an England point of view, pretty disappointing series for anyone that was following the cricket.
I thought you were going to say, let's not dwell on the Tour Down Under.
What a start to the season that was, eh?
I was going to say that England cyclists got their own back in the Tour Down Under. The Ashes on bikes, 3 stage wins for English riders and 2 stage wins for Australian riders. So I guess we got a series win there.
One of those stage wins from an Australian rider for an English team as well.
Oh, of course, yeah. Sam Welsford for Ineos Grenadiers. So a little bit of sporting pride restored after a pretty underwhelming series on the cricket pitch.
The problem is, though, did Jay Vine not take the urn for Australia? Because he took the GC, didn't he? Teary me.
Is that how it works? Yeah.
Chaps, I think, or Lionel, when we recorded last week, we suggested that it was pretty much done and dusted. We had one of the 2 hilly stages that were sort of on the menu. That was the one over Corkscrew Road, gave us the victory of Vine on the Corkscrew Road. I enjoyed that. But he and, of course, Jonathan Narváez had gone away on their own, and they'd taken out about a minute, hadn't they? They had about a minute gap on the rest of the field after that stage. And we suggested that the sort of UAE 1-2 was done and dusted. We wondered whether there might even be a UAE clean sweep. However, no sooner had we finished recording than it was the next day, wasn't it? Narváez crashed out of the race. Vine, incidentally, have we already mentioned this? He would also crash. We crashed on that last day, and we have subsequently learned broke his wrist in the process, and he's now going to be out for some time, I believe. But that didn't prevent him from winning his second Tour Down Under. Of course, he won it in 2023 as well. But we mentioned a couple of the British riders there. Matthew Brennan ended up winning one stage, but I thought looked very impressive in the sprints. And the only question mark from my point of view is how much help he's going to get in sprints this year, especially bearing in mind some of the personnel issues that we've discussed at Visma, Lisa Bike, them losing Simon Yates, of course. That was one sort of talking point, certainly, as far as I was concerned. Harry Sweeney riding very well to finish third, but some of the other sort of highlights or things that you chaps noticed?
Well, I certainly saw Ineos Grenadiers hitting the ground running with a prologue win for Sam Watson, which we talked about last week, and then Sam Welsford winning the sprint stage as well. His first race for Ineos Grenadiers, of course, after joining them from Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe. It gives them a bit of an edge in the sprint, something that they were probably looking for when they signed Caleb Ewan. It didn't work out longer term with Caleb Ewan. But we've often said in the past, haven't we, the thing about Team Sky and Ineos Grenadiers is that the focus has been so squarely on the Tour de France and having kind of GC-type riders. They've really neglected the sprinting. Even when they had Mark Cavendish, it was very much a plan B, wasn't it? His 1 year with Team Sky. But we've seen from other teams, especially in this era where it's very, very difficult to challenge for major race wins up against Tadej Pogacar and Jonas Vingegaard, you know, the Giro, the Tour and the Vuelta potentially sort of off limits for them. For a lot of other teams, having a good sprinter who can rack up some wins definitely helps the team morale, and it just sort of knits everything together. So I don't think there's any coincidence that Ineos Grenadiers have, you know, they've given themselves a good start to the season and specifically sort of targeted trying to get wins early on, because as the world, there's a bit of a lull now, isn't there, really? I mean, I know there's the Cadel Evans race as well, but the World Tour goes into a little bit of hibernation until the UAE Tour, I think, is the next one. And it's really important for all of the teams to get off to a good start and not be the team that everyone's focusing on in sort of late February, March into April, still waiting for their first World Tour win of the season.
I suppose one note of caution, if I can add it already before we hear from Rob, is that Sam Welsford last year did not win a race after how many stages did he win? 3 stages last year at the Tour Down Under. And it was much the same story. Even the previous year, he won 1 stage in the Tour of Hungary in 2024. But there again, he had won 3 stages in the Tour Down Under. And apart from that stage in Hungary, nothing else for the rest of the year. So, I mean, the job that he and Ineos have got in front of them, as far as he's concerned, is to prove that he's not just the ultimate one, not just flat track bully, to use cricket parlance, but also early season bully.
Well, I'd say that the stage he won in Tour Down Under wasn't batting on a flat track at all. I was actually in the one of the team cars for that stage, and you could see on the final climb before the drop down to the town there were quite a few, I would say, thinner leg sprinters than you were
in the Ineos team car.
In one of the team cars.
Which team car?
I was in Picnic Postenel's car.
Speaking Lancastrian with your mates.
Yes. <Okay. laughs> Deary me. I was thinking I miss you two so much, and I come back and this is a reception. I'm just going to get more northern. It's because we're coming tour and all that, aren't we? Tour de France is coming.
It's when you write in at Lancastrian as well on your Instagram story. Then I've got absolutely
no
clue
like that?
What you're going on about.
No?
Anyway, go on. Sorry.
All right. I'll just hang on. Just let me phone Chippy and put my order in. No, I was in a team car, and we could see quite a few of the sort of thinner leg sprinters, you know, that sort of second tier sprinters who might expect to contest things on a hillier day, a difficult day, being dropped out the back. And you're automatically thinking that Al Welsford must be gone as well. We've just not seen him. And it comes through on the radio that he's there and won. And then afterwards, I did speak to Daryl Impey, the new sports director at Ineos, and he was saying that he was just off the back over the top, had to really work hard to get back on afterwards. And it sounds like it was a really, really good win for Sam Welsford. I know he was dreaming of winning the Nationals the week before in Perth, but having been at that race as well, that was a really difficult, grippy course in Kings Park over in Perth. There was a big descent and there wasn't much time where you were off the pedals. There was a small section alongside the Swan River before it then climbed up again. There was always something going on there. So that was a really sporty course in the Australian Nationals over in Perth. So he obviously missed out there and it would have been a big ask. But I think that sprint that he did win this year in the Tour Down Under was actually one of the more difficult sprints that there was.
He's an intriguing rider, Welsford, because he's obviously got great pedigree as a track rider, and he's got a reputation as someone who is willing to take a lot of risks, and he's a very good bike handler. But as I said, he's had this sort of very patchy World Tour career so far. A couple of results that have suggested that big things are coming, and it hasn't quite materialised. I mean, obviously, he worked under Matt Winston, Rob. I don't know how many races Matt did with him, or whether Matt was able to give you any insight.
No, I know they did work quite a bit together. And I actually remember commentating. I think it was it the Renewi Tour? What was the Eneco Tour? He maybe took a first world tour win. I sort of have that sort of brief memory of that. And again, you're expecting big things. But then, you know, the big money transfer comes, doesn't it? He went to what was Bora Hansgrohe, now Red Bull. They've obviously started to focus on things that are much more GC-centric. So naturally, there's less focus on sprinting there. He's not going to get to go to all the big races. And maybe he sees an opportunity at Ineos, given the fact that they haven't been competing so well in Grand Tours in recent years, to maybe get a slot at one of the big races. We'll have to see. But he's going to have to prove himself, isn't he? And string together a run of results and wins in other races that aren't the Tour Down Under, really.
Yeah, he's had a very few opportunities in the Grand Tours. He's only ridden one, the 2023 Tour de France, which he finished. I remember he was kind of, I think maybe a couple of top tens was about all he did in that 2023 Tour de France for DSM, as they were then. And then, of course, the move to Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe, you would think, well, that's going to give him opportunities, but it didn't work out that way. Not a great-looking race programme for a couple of seasons. So a bit of a reboot and a restart for Welsford. And looking at the Ineos Grenadiers lineup, you would think he would get an opportunity somewhere in some big races this year. Maybe, I don't know, the Giro d'Italia or the Vuelta. Probably not the Tour de France. But yeah, I think you're right. He probably needs to string a few things together and have a solid-ish spring to make a claim for a place in one of the Grand Tours, and then who knows?
It'll be interesting to see what percentage of Ineos Grenadiers race wins this year, and I think they will take a few. What percent come in sprints? Because all of a sudden, it's looking like quite a sprinty team, with the likes of Godon, Watson as well. He seems to be getting faster and faster. We've even seen Tarling doing the odd sort of bunch sprint, kind of moving in that direction. And then, you know, you've got the fast French riders, Vauclin, Laurence as well. And it's looking very different from what it was a few years ago, that team, certainly. Chaps, it was a bit remiss of me, actually, not to mention Mauro Schmidt as well. He was second on overall. Harry Sweeney, as I said, third. Chaps, anything else to say about, I mean, we don't want to belittle Jay Vine winning for the second time. We haven't said much about that, but really, it was all about that one stage, wasn't it, in Corkscrew Road. Not really a surprise. He was clearly the strongest rider in the race. We talked about that with Larry last week, and you know, Larry talked about how that UAE pair superiority, Narváez and Vine, was almost embarrassing on that stage.
Yeah, you're right, Daniel. I mean, Jay Vine had it in the bag, really, after Corkscrew Hill. Then, obviously, UAE Team Emirates lost Jonathan Narváez in that crash. And stage four, Willunga Hill, wasn't going to trouble Jay Vine in the overall. But it would have been a different race if the circuit on Willunga Hill hadn't been cancelled because of the risk of wildfires. And they shortened the stage, didn't they? And temperatures were very, very high. So it wasn't necessarily the extreme weather protocol, was it, Rob? I gather it was the risk of fires in the countryside around the circuit. So it was a safety issue. But what was it like being there? I mean, 40-odd degrees, pretty warm. I mean, okay for cricket, but cycling, it's at the upper end of what's tolerable, really, isn't it?
It was. And I think one key thing to add in about the heat in South Australia is it's a much drier heat than the ones that you find, for example, over in Victoria, where we've got the Cadel Evans Great Ocean Road Race at the minute, or certainly in Sydney, which is much more like a sort of Mediterranean coastal heat where you get quite a bit of humidity. And let's say 33 degrees feels actually more difficult to withstand than 40 degrees in Adelaide, where it's, you know, only 11% humidity it was the other day. So it's a very different heat. But again, you're still talking about 40 plus degrees. It is very, very difficult. Hydration is almost impossible to keep on top of. Effectively, as you were saying, instead of the extreme weather protocol being brought in, it was actually the risk of bushfires, wildfires. And it's something that I noticed a couple of days before, just driving through a couple of these very small Adelaide Hill towns. You know, everywhere in Australia's got a cricket oval or an AFL oval. So it's where you play cricket in the summer and Australian rules football in the winter. And there were signs outside a couple of these small villages and towns saying that in the event of fire, you must go to the oval and wait. It is that isolated, that extreme, that it would be dangerous to get in your car and drive through the forest, essentially, down towards the city. And it was so dry. It was a tinderbox. It really was. I sent Daniel a couple of pictures of kangaroos and things earlier on today that I'd seen out there, and just general images from the race. And you can see how barren it was. And again, you fly to Spain or Italy in the middle of summer, you see a little bit of it. But this was on another level. It would have taken maybe an exhaust fume or a cigarette butt in the whole place. And you've suddenly got, you know, 5,000 people in between fans, riders, staff that the race would have taken into a remote area, putting people in emergency services under pressure. And I think if the race hadn't made that decision, I had it on pretty good authority that the state of South Australia was going to have to make the call and intervene and say, oh, this is too dangerous because of the risk here. It was very, very high. And the risk was so high. The day I left was Australia Day, the national day in Australia. And apparently in South Australia, it was the hottest ever Australia Day on record. It was 45 degrees in Adelaide City. It was 49.5 elsewhere in the state. So the conditions really were extreme. So as much as it would have been nice to see a bigger battle with the GC, less maybe domination and less sort of a penalty kick to kick away and finish for Jay Vine, although it wasn't as easy as Daniel, I'm sure, will tell us in a minute, with the wildlife getting in the way. But it was the right thing to do. And unfortunately, it was just what the event organisers and the riders had to play with.
Rob, just very briefly, talking about climate change, Santos, Tour Down Under, sponsored by an oil and gas company, that's a company that has been accused for years of greenwashing. And I was led to believe that fairly sizable protests had been arranged and they may even disrupt the race. That didn't materialise, did it?
I did see a couple of protests. Again, I only actually physically went to a couple of the stages. I was certainly hanging around the prologue, which is a brilliantly organised event, much better than the criterium, I think, that they used to have. There were people exercising their right to protest. They were there, but it wasn't particularly big, I have to say. The police were escorting them. They were going about their thing. They walked the whole length of the course, but I would have said that there weren't huge numbers there at all. You know, the thing passed within the space of 2 minutes from where I was standing.
I mean, this is an issue that is affecting cycling, but it's affecting other sports as well. It's been extremely hot at the Australian Open tennis as well, and they've had to shift the schedule a little bit to try and make sure it's safe for the players to play. We've seen it in Europe, haven't we, in recent years, extremes of weather. And I suppose on occasions like this, it is impossible not to see the sort of dotted line that joins the identity of some of the sponsors and the real world situations that an outdoor sport like cycling is beginning to face. And there'll be people who say, well, these two things are completely unconnected. But I think, you know, climate science is pretty unanimous on the changes. And certainly there might need to be some shifts in the calendar. You know, we talk a little bit about the viability of the Vuelta a España in sort of August and the Tour de France in the height of a French summer in July. But maybe the first event that might need to think about moving slightly on the schedule will be the Tour Down Under, because there's huge commercial opportunities for some kind of swing on the cycling calendar. We've talked about this before. You know, it doesn't make sense for Australia to be the real outlier. It makes more sense to have a world tour that does make a sort of coherent, logical move around the world with perhaps fewer but bigger events. And maybe this is the start of the time when everyone involved in running professional cycling need to think about what the real world temperatures are and reshape the calendar to fit in with the real world circumstances. The other thing, Daniel, you mentioned the kangaroo crash on the final stage. Jay Vine fractured his wrist. As you say, the kangaroo had to be put down. It was interesting that, because obviously the race was going on through the night, so I was catching up with it when I got up here, and of course saw the initial kind of flurry of reports on social media. You know, what could be more Australian than a kangaroo causing havoc in a bike race, and a sort of certain I suppose novelty comedy value to it, which then when it became apparent that the kangaroo had to be put down and was so seriously injured, it sort of made me think, you know, that once again, we're dealing with a sport that takes place in a real world environment. And, you know, it's always the way, isn't it, on the Tour de France, when the horse escapes from a field and runs alongside the peloton, or we see a flock of sheep running alongside the peloton. It's just a reminder, isn't it, that racing on open roads through the countryside, well, probably the kangaroo has more right to be there than a World Tour peloton, I guess. Well, you know, what can you do?
I don't think there's anything you can do.
Avoid incidents like that. I mean, it's unfortunate. Nailed that one.
Yeah. That's killed it. That's killed the atmosphere a bit. No, I tell you what, Lionel, one thing you did say in there that I really have to reiterate, having been down under for just over 6 weeks, I actually stopped and really struggled to follow the football while I was down there, the time difference. And I really, what really, really struck me, and obviously having commentated on a couple of the Ashes tests from London before going out there as well, the commitment that everybody has and a lot of our listeners have down under to follow this sport was really hit home to me. I really have a newfound respect for it. And I tell you what, people absolutely love watching the cycling down there. And, you know, the commitment they have to make throughout the year, when for us, we might complain about the Tour Down Under, oh, I'm not bothered going to watching it because it's in the middle of the night. And I've been as guilty of the rest of doing that. You know, I've not always been that keen to commentate on it because it's in the middle of the night as well. And I've always started with the European races. But I have a newfound respect for people staying up in the middle of the night and how well organised that event is as well, because they really make an event of it. And I think there's a lot that can be learned in European races from what the Tour Down Under organisers do.
Having been there, Rob, now, would you say that they should do the... it's about time they did something about the time difference?
Oh, yeah, sort it out. Kangaroos, time difference, let's sort it out. Come on.
Make it a nocturne.
Well, it's good you mentioned the nocturne line, because I think Rob attended an event that bore a certain similarity to nocturne events that happen on the continent of Europe. Let's hear a little bit about your other adventures, or one of your other adventures in Australia, Rob.
Now then, when I arrived in Australia 6 weeks ago, the last thing I would have imagined doing on the penultimate night in the country would to be hanging around a multi-story car park. But that's exactly what I'm doing. There's a very small side street in the east end of Adelaide, closed off. There's a DJ on, a big arch, yes, a very famous soft drink, energy drink, let's say, is the big sponsors. They always are at these kind of events. The local bars and cafes are open, and there were riders signing on. Local riders from all over Australia, people have brought their bikes here to the Tour Down Under. And the aim of the game is to get up six stories, I think. I'm looking, there's people hanging out of a multi-story car park, a bit like an old-fashioned football stadium where there's not quite room for everybody in the terraces. So I've made it inside, people trying to cross the car park, and there's sort of barriers like you find at a big stage race, actually. You've got riders dressed up, full gear on, trying to get as aero as possible. First few gradients don't look too bad, but this is a race, a hill climb in effect.
My name's Yash, I'm from a small country town called Barrel near Sydney. It's so bizarre, like I'm just here and there's people just riding up the car park, and they're doing pretty well, and then guess who I see? I see Rob Hatch out here.
Degrees earlier, it's 20 past 7 in the evening now. I think we're about 10 minutes from the start of the event, and it's still saying what, 38 degrees? Yeah, no wonder I got a sweat on. Getting the sort of disco lights, the music's getting louder. Tell you, I'm looking over the edge of the car park. We're high up now. This is, I don't know the elevation or the profile of this, but and I have just seen a member of the Cycling Podcast family, Ian Boswell, on his way back down after his recon. We'll see how he gets on. I know he's racing against the likes of Romain Bardet and Caleb Ewan. So where normally you'd be getting your ticket, going to find a pay and display machine, level 6, there is a queue for the lift and a queue of about 20 people on bikes waiting to get back down to the start. We've just seen the Cycling Podcast very own Ian Boswell absolutely smoke Romain Bardet in the sprint. Six flights and it was up. And I've just run into Matt Winston. I mean, no sports directing duties tonight.
No, I thought it's a pretty cool concept, this. Definitely want to come down and have a look, and, you know, who knows, maybe Preston bus station. No, I think it's really cool, though, and, like, fair play. You bring the city, the Tour Down Under is so cool, like, just the event village and bringing everyone together, and the organisation then putting on extra events like this just to allow people to be involved is fantastic. And I think a lot of events can learn a lot from something like this. It's, who'd have thought on a 43 degree day?
Well, Rob, that sounded like a bit of a hoot. Our good friend Ian Boswell being crowned the car park champion. A couple of slight quibbles I've got with this.
Here we go.
A couple of slight issues I've got with this. And of course, we've talked about this before on the podcast. I was the pioneer of this sport. Multi-story car park racing at the Tour de France in about 2008 with Ellis Bacon, who is actually a resident of Adelaide. Now, we had our folding bikes at that Tour de France, and we had a car park prologue. I think, in fact, you can still find a report online, probably on Bike Radar. But that is good fun, riding around car parks. I think it's quite common now, isn't it? I've seen other events.
It's funny, I spoke to another journalist who said they'd invented the genre the other day as well.
Who was that?
A certain Kaylee Fretz.
Oh, no, definitely wasn't Kaylee. Kaylee wasn't even writing about cycling then. I'm going to get in trouble.
I've started a war anyway, now. Hearing me.
And in 2008, it was around about when Kaylee started. Anyway, no, we didn't hear from Ian Boswell, and he won. He was the car park champion. Car park champion, of course, that is a moniker that was long used for the golfer, Sergio Ballesteros. Because, Lionel, you might know about this incident. In 1979 Open Championship, it was the big sort of breakthrough for Sergio Ballesteros, who was a legend, went on to become a legend of golf. And for years, I read about this extraordinary drive that he'd hit almost at right angles off the 16th tee, and he'd gone into a car park, and then he'd hit this miraculous shot onto the green. And thanks to that shot, he was able to win that Open Championship. I think he was 21 or 22 at the time, very young. And this was one of the most famous moments ever in golf history. If you go onto YouTube and look this up, 1979, Sergio Ballesteros, your balloon will be burst, because the car park was just off the fairway and he had a little chip onto the green, and it really isn't everything that it was made out to be.
That's disappointing. I'll tell you what, while you're on the subject of Ballesteros, I thought of you the other week when I was watching the news. I thought, I wonder if this is Daniel. Have they got to him? Have they arrested him yet? Because apparently Seve's statue got robbed. I thought that was you, and you put it up in your in your garden or something.
Big cycling fan, of course. I interviewed him about cycling for the official guide of the Tour de France. Anyway, Rob, that sounded like good fun.
It was. It was an absolutely brilliant event. Again, I sort of, as I said in the package, stumbled upon it. And Ian Boswell, you talked about winning. I mean, he beat Richie Port, Caleb Ewan, Romain Bardet, and all the host of other people.
The course would suit. Boss.
Oh,
I mean,
he's on form,
like,
is the
bit
boss.
Like a
he's
crit.
On form. He's on form. He might be turning pro again soon. Who knows?
How big? I mean, you joked there about the profile, but I'm quite disappointed that you didn't make the profile available to us. I was curious after listening to that.
I was on the holidays.
I mean, what kind of gradients were we talking? What kind of length were the sort of ramps between the floors?
I don't know. Seemed a lot longer on the way down after a couple of pints anyway.
Romain Bardet also rode, and he won a gravel race as well, didn't he?
He did, yes.
Australia. This, I think, has escaped a few people's notice, that Romain Bardet, I was under the impression that he was going to pursue this sort of second life as a gravel rider for Picnic post NL. And no, he has signed for a Rafa-backed team, I believe. Well, that was who he won this race for. Crocodile Bardet, they're calling him now. Down there,
apparently. You alerted me to this the other day, yeah, just while he was sat about two rows behind me on the plane. I was trying to sort of hide my phone, make sure he wasn't sort of walking past to the loo or the bar or something.
That's all from Australia.
Probably best.
This episode is also sponsored by NordVPN, the fastest virtual private network in the world. I'm sure everybody knows by now what a virtual private network can offer you. Primarily, it's to protect your personal data when you're online, really important things like bank details and passwords and your online identity. and it will protect all of your data, especially when you're using public Wi-Fi on the move, perhaps your phone on 5G or connected up to hotel Wi-Fi. NordVPN will protect you wherever you are in the world. And back in the day, I used to think that my internet connections at home were safe and secure no matter what. But signing up for NordVPN and seeing just how it can protect all of my data and especially keep me safe from viruses, malicious malware and phishing websites, I've really realised how important a VPN is. And NordVPN is the best of the lot. You can use one NordVPN account on up to 10 devices. It's affordable. And with the Cycling Podcast, you can get a great deal because with our unique URL, which is nordvpn.com/TCP, you'll get 4 months extra for free when you buy a 2-year plan. And that will keep you surfing the internet wherever you are in the world for the next 2 years without even thinking about your internet security. Safe and secure with NordVPN. It's risk-free too because they're the 30-day money-back guarantee. If you decide it's not for you, go to nordvpn.com/TCP. The link is in the podcast episode notes as well.
Right, chaps, next stop, Saudi Arabia or Mallorca. The choice is yours.
Well, we're making our way back from Australia, so I suppose we ought to stop off in Saudi.
Stop over in Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. Not finished, of course, yet, the Alula Tour. But today we had, was it the sort of queen stage? Certainly it's a stage. Well, I'll just bring up the actual names of the places it went from and to. It's a stage that we have, well, the Alula Tour has featured every year, isn't it? It's a finish that the Alula Tour has featured every year. One of the hilly days. It went from Winter Park to Bir Jaydar Mountain Wicca. I'm sure that's not how you pronounce it. But it was won by Yanis Voisin of the French-speaking part of Switzerland. I think he's from near Basel, actually, Basel, which is actually really a bilingual city. But he rides for Tudor Pro Cycling, and that was a fascinating finish. Did you chaps manage to catch that? It looked very much as though Jan Christen was going to win that stage with a, well, he attacked very hard with 2 kilometres to go. And Jan Christen, obviously, with the way UAE have started the season and the way they rode last season, he kind of come into this race, the Alula Tour, probably is the favourite for GC, has looked like the strongest rider, but he's also been sort of causing a bit of a stir for various other antics, some histrionics when he crashed on the first day, sort of pushing other riders out of the way and sort of basically looking like the sort of Marc Soler of Juan Ayuso's, if you can imagine what one of those would be like. But he's getting that sort of reputation, isn't he, Jan Christen?
We saw that last year. Wasn't there a race when we were talking about all of this Juan Ayuso stuff and, you know, doing your own thing? And I have this memory of a lot of Spanish fans coming up saying, oh, well, he's doing it as well. And it was a race towards the end of the season where he basically hadn't obeyed the instructions of his leader and he'd gone off and tried and taken it himself.
There were a few moments like that last year. There was the Algarve. There was a little bit of beef there. Tour de Suisse as well. He supposedly, reportedly, didn't want to work with João Almeida. But he's kind of getting this reputation. I must say, we don't hear a lot from Jan Christen. I don't think he's done that many interviews, so it's difficult to sort of get a read on his character. I've spoken to his brother a couple of times, Fabio, who's a very placid character, but Jan is a different beast. And look, I sort of welcome it. I quite like it when these characters come along. People will call it petulant. People will say that he's too volatile and that he needs to temper some of that if he's going to become the rider a lot of people think he's going to become, because he's obviously very talented. But it is quite entertaining.
Yeah, he got it wrong though today, didn't he? I mean, he laid it all out there, sort of wielded the big hammer, but couldn't finish it off, couldn't see it through, because at one point it was him away with Gianmarco Garofoli of Sudal Quickstep and it looked like a done deal. All he's got to do here is shake off Garofoli and the stage win and the jersey is Jan Christen's. But there was a bit of sort of hesitation. Maybe the gradient caught him out a bit, but a group came across, and then it was one of those finishes where it looked like several people might win. I thought for a minute Afonso Eulalio of Bahrain Victorious was the favourite because he was looking very strong and riding quite smart. Then Sergio Higuita of XDS Astana kind of opened it up, and even he went a little bit early, and it was, Yanis Voisart, Tudor Pro Cycling, a surprise. I mean, I had to kind of, you know, look up what his pedigree is, what he's won before, and not a whole lot. A stage of the Tour of Hungary in 2023, his previous professional win. He's been with Tudor Pro Cycling for a few years, and a very impressive win in terms of the timing and the company that he was with and ultimately beat.
He's been there since the start, Voisart. He's an interesting character in the team. He actually beat Juan Ayuso in the under-23 Giro, Station Nevegal, and finished seventh overall on GC back in, 2021. So he has been talented since the youth categories. And, of course, that's something that will carry with him. And I think that'll be a nice feeling for Tudor because they've invested in him since the very start. And he's not one of these sort of big money signings they've made in the last couple of years. So, a bit of organic growth bringing a victory for Tudor.
We can't move on from the Alula Tour without mentioning the Milan Derby on stage one. Jonathan Milan of Lidl Trek won his first race of the season ahead of Milan Fretin in the sprint.
I know that a friend of ours, Killian Kelly, is very, who of course is, stats are his thing. He's very excited about the prospect of Jonathan Milan winning the stage to Milan. In the Giro d'Italia, this will be the first time that we've ever seen such, I don't even know, nominative determinism is the right word for this, but basically, someone's name being a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy. Don't think it's ever happened before in a Grand Tour, but it could happen. Hasn't happened with Peo Bilbao, although he's had a few opportunities, but it could happen with Milan. Incidentally, just on yesterday's sprint, Milan beat another rider who hails from the same part of Italy as him, Daniel Sciurl. He's from Trieste, but a really interesting rider because he's a sprinter, but he really struggled last year in his first pro season. But he's quite highly rated. He was quite highly rated in the under 23 ranks. But he's got a very interesting backstory in the sense that his father is Italian, his mother is Colombian, but he grew up right on the Slovenian border and speaks fluent Slovenian. He went to a bilingual school. So it's a rare bird. And it was good to see him up there with Milan, who I presume he knows well, because they're both from Friuli, as I said. A couple of days left in that race, isn't that, Alula Tour? Rob, you might know the answer to this. Another thing struck me as curious, why is only Cofidis there of the French teams? Because that's an ASO race. Clubamart aren't there and Decathlon aren't there, which I thought was strange.
I don't have the answer to that, but you're right in saying that it's an ASO run race. I'm not sure of the ownership of it, but I know that it is run by them. Also, it's a pro tour race, so there's no obligation for world tour teams to go. The only thing you can think of is that people are running different programs. It's the French opener this week, isn't it? So they've got to be racing in Marseille. There's another half of the team that is in the world tour down at Cadel Evans Great Ocean Road Race still.
Groupama have only raced in Australia so far. That's the only place they've raced. And As I say, I don't have any information on this, but this speaks to the sort of strain that the calendar does put on a lot of World Tour teams. We'll see UAE again. Probably last year, I think we saw Astana race more days than any other World Tour team because that was part of their strategy to avoid relegation, and second were UAE, and that has been the case for a couple of years. UAE, of course, they've made it their mission to finish on top of the UCI rankings. We'll probably see UAE with the highest number of race days again, but teams sort of more in the middle of the pack, they do struggle sometimes to field teams across the globe and across the calendar. Is that enough on Saudi Arabia? Should we just say, just in case anyone is listening, soon as this episode drops, there will be, after stage three, 2 days left. Am I right in saying? 2 days left, and the current general classification is led by Yanis Voisart by 4 seconds from Eulalio, and 3 seconds from Higuita. To Mallorca, a lot of hype, interest, I suppose, about this team time trial in the Challenge Mallorca. As we've said before, this is a sort of stage race with a buffet arrangement. You can pick your stages. There is no general classification. Or there is a prize. Is there a prize? There's a prize for the overall.
There is, but there's no UCI points. Yeah, no one. There's a local sponsor's prize, yes.
Yes, but it's basically a series of one-day races back-to-back run as though they were a stage race. And this year, there is a team time trial. This is important because, of course, the Tour de France is going to kick off with a team time trial just over the Mediterranean in Barcelona. That's going to be 19 kilometres. Today was 23 kilometres, if I'm not mistaken.
24 today. So there's 24 today. 24. The thing that struck me, though, was the rules. I assumed, and I had to read through the rules this morning, I assumed that they would have tried to simulate what was going to happen in terms of having the first rider across the line to take the time, which we're seeing in these ASO races now, we're going to see in the Tour. But they went with traditional rules, fourth rider across the line.
Yeah, that only really works. That only really works if there is some sort of climb in the last 2 or 3 kilometres, as has been the case in Paris. Is it sort of 3 years? I think it's 3 years now that Paris has used this format. And on each occasion, there's been a bit of some kind of ramp or rise or little climb in the last 2 or 3 kilometres. Because, of course, then the tactic becomes, the strategy becomes to launch your best GC contenders, your best GC riders on that final climb, and everyone else sort of melts away. I suppose on a flat course, it doesn't really work. It
also doesn't really work if there's no GC. So, you know, there's no incentive other than a stage win to propel your one rider away. So, yes, it was sort of old school team time trial rules, wasn't it? With fourth rider over the line of the seven, the time taken with the fourth rider over the line. And it was interesting, wasn't it? I mean, we were debating last week with Larry, or rather I asked Larry, did he think that teams would take all of their time trial kit, given the logistics and the work for the mechanics and all of that? And he sort of dismissed the notion that they might do it on road bikes out of hand, which surprised me. But then thinking about it, it doesn't make much sense to have a team time trial in a year when there's a team time trial at the Tour de France and then have everybody race on road bikes. So it was interesting to see an early hit out, especially for UAE Team Emirates and Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe, with Remco Evenepoel, of course, making his debut for Red Bull after that big money transfer.
Yeah, the lack of those new rules, by the way, probably saved a bit of an embarrassing situation early season for Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe, because it saved them having to make a decision between Lipovic and Evenepoel and sort of upset them early season and things like that.
Yeah, I was paying close attention to their body language. We should say that Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe won the team time trial as expected, but by a fairly slender margin. 4 seconds they put into Movistar, who was second, and third were Jayco Alula, 17 seconds down, UAE fourth, 19 seconds down, Tudor fifth, 19 seconds down. But yeah, I was watching the body language, and we've talked already a few times, haven't we, about how Lipovic and Evenepoel are going to gel or not. And I think this is just his character, Lipovic. I've sort of described him as a very kind of unassuming character, quite an introvert, I think. But to me, he looked a little bit sort of tentative around Remco, trying to sort of establish eye contact to see if, you know, it was the right moment to kind of give him a hug or say a few words of congratulations. But I don't know. I mean, this is fag packet body language analysis from someone who has no expertise in body language analysis. So much like anything we see and hear at this time of the year, and this is another thing that I wanted to sort of establish today in the podcast, was that not a lot of what we see is really that relevant for what comes in 2 or 3 months. And I was going to say this particularly in relation to some of the things that Remco Evenepoel has been saying about how he's really enjoying it at Red Bull. Everything's great, and he really needed this, and his time trial position's improved, and he's going even faster, and so on and so forth. I would take it all with a very, very, well, a pinch of very fine salt. Table salt, not molten salt or rock salt. And yes, and we should also take whatever we saw of their body language today with a pinch of salt.
Well, maybe it was up then that the finish was in Salinas, where the salt flats are. There you go.
But you wouldn't quibble with that, would you, Lionel? You would agree with me, wouldn't you? I mean, Remco's not gonna go in and say, "I'm not sure about the aerodynamics, guy."
Every bike is better than last year's. Every bike is better than the last brand.
On what date can we sort of throw all those disclaimers out of the window? I don't think you can really take anything seriously until, say, how many days are in March? 31 days in March. 31st of March.
I think it's the sort of thing that slips out, isn't it? You know, when a rider's unhappy with the equipment, and then suddenly it's the biggest talking point, and then they have to put the genie back in the bottle. You're right though about Evenepoel and Lipovic, and it is important that they get on personally and professionally with the Tour de France. A big objective for Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe. You would have to say Remco Evenepoel is their best bet of the two. Lipovic is still pretty green, and last year's Tour de France result has to be built on before he could really kind of assert himself and make a claim to rival Evenepoel. So I don't imagine it's a case of these races are about establishing a pecking order. I'm sure the pecking order is already established, but Lipovic is a very, very good rider to have as part of that team, and waiting in the wings should anything sort of go wrong between now and the start of July for Evenepoel.
Daniel, you mentioned March. Evenepoel's now scheduled to ride Valencia in February, UAE Tour February, and just coming right to the end of those 31 days in March is the Volta Ciclista Catalunya. Three stage races in. There's always a moment with Remco, isn't there? And well, your betting might be right.
Having just said we should pay absolutely no attention to anything and everything the riders say at this time of the year, I'm now going to proceed to invite you to deconstruct, dissect and speculate about this, which I think is, well, was eye-catching from Remco in an interview with Daniel Benson in Mallorca a couple of days ago. This quote: "My gut says that if everything goes well, I can go for second place at the Tour de France." Rob's got his head in his hands. Eye-catching. Would you not agree?
If I were the CEO of Red Bull, I would be not particularly happy with that. I know that Tadej Pogacar is Tadej Pogacar. You have to be realistic, but you've got to play the game, haven't you? You've got to think you can win, for goodness sake.
Yeah, but do you have to say it? Do you have to say it? Are you contractually obliged to say it?
Even if you don't think you can win, you have to say it. You're being paid to win.
Napalm, can you win the Tour de France?
Well, it's fortunately not something I've ever had to worry about, or indeed will have to worry about. But I can see both sides of that one, really, because all of these quotes get dissected, don't they? And micro-analysed. If you asked 100 cycling fans who really follow the sport who's going to win the Tour de France, if it was a straight shootout between Tadej Pogacar and Remco Evenepoel, I'd imagine it would be heavily in favour of Tadej Pogacar. So Remco Evenepoel doesn't have to put any extra pressure on himself. What he has to do is get himself into the best possible shape to challenge Tadej Pogacar and then, you know, deliver the result. And I don't know whether would their PR department be thinking, well, this is a, you know, this quote makes us look a bit silly. I mean, it could be a fantastic piece of reverse psychology. I don't know.
I mean, this doesn't sound very Red Bull, does it? My gut says, he doesn't even say I can get second place. He says, my gut says that if everything goes well, I can go for second place. To my mind, it's quite un-Remco. Like, you wouldn't associate that sort of statement with the Remco of 2 or 3 years ago.
That's the part of it I have the issue with. If I can go for second place. So, like, you know, he doesn't have to say I'm going to win it, does he? You know, he doesn't have to say I'm going to take down that Slovenian shot. Yeah, but he has to go in and try, just sort of giving up on it is the issue I sort of have with it. I think it sounds very, very strange, given what he's being paid, given all the hype behind him, given the fact that he's made this big move. It just seems a sort of, you know, okay, we'll start the FA Cup this year, but you know, maybe we can get to the final and lose it. What?
Do you know what? I think that this is probably a reaction to having been burned before by things he said in the media. And I think this is him trying his very hardest to be circumspect and to not come across as brash.
I also think that the microscope is so trained on him in Belgium. If he said, I'm going to win the Tour, that's a much, much bigger story. That blows up in a way that it wouldn't for a lot of other riders. And because he's Remco Evenepoel, it's not like, I don't know, Enric Mas saying, I can win the Tour, just to pick a rider at random. You know, most people would kind of dismiss that out of hand and say, well, you know, good on you for believing, Enric, but that's not going to happen. Where with Remco Evenepoel, he doesn't get that kind of allowance. He doesn't get that grace, I guess. From a Red Bull PR point of view, I mean, Red Bull gives you wings in the same way that the flightless bird, the dodo, has wings, I guess. I mean, there could be some fantastic marketing opportunities here for Red Bull or Hansgrohe.
I'm feeling remorseful now for not having compiled a list of the sort of top 10 kind of grandiose statements of intent in cycling history that sort of that fell flat on their face. I mean, there's an infamous one with Simon Yates at the Giro d'Italia a few years ago, which he then regretted and he then sort of made a joke of himself. But there have been a few over the years, riders who were hopelessly ill-equipped to win Tour de France or whatever other race they proclaimed they were going to win. I remember Ivan Rovni, who ended up becoming a sort of middle of the pack domestique for Katusha at the start of his career, saying that he thought he was going to win the Tour de France at some point in his career. But anyway, we shall see. We shall see. But I thought that was intriguing. We still haven't talked about Jonas Vingegaard and talking about riders who have won the Tour de France.
Well, first, Daniel, we ought to just recap the first race in Mallorca as well, shouldn't we, really? I suppose the Trofeo Calvia. That was the race last year that Jan Christen won, wasn't it, Rob? And Antonio Morgado was third when UAE Team Emirates were mob-handed at the front there. Well, this year, Morgado won for UAE Team Emirates, the opening race in the Challenge Mallorca, and there's three more to go as we speak, isn't there? The good one, Tramontana, that's tomorrow, is it? And then Andrac, and then the sprinty one in Parma on Sunday.
Yeah, so Trofeo Tramontana tomorrow. That's sort of two loops around the sort of northern side of the Tramontana mountain range. All the sort of famous climbs that people come to ride as tourists and training camps take in a lot of. The same road is taken on. It's the whole coast road on Saturday for Andrac Pujensa. Need to check, but sometimes has an uphill finish. Usually has an uphill finish. I think it does up at Miradores Colomer. That's the famous climb out towards the lighthouse, sort of stopping before it gets all the way there. And then, as you say, Sunday lunchtime takes them to Palma. The Morgado win on his birthday, 22 years old. It was the fourth win of the season already for UAE, who've already won more than anybody else, given their three victories down under. Jay Vine taking all three of those so far, time trial, and then a stage and the overall at the Tour Down Under. But Morgado, and the other big headline for me was Héctor Álvarez. What a performance that was from a 19-year-old who isn't certain yet, or at least it hasn't been announced, that he'll turn pro at the end of this year when he finishes with the development team at Lidl Trek. But he was riding for the Spanish national team, and yeah, 19, he looked very, very mature. He spoke a good game afterwards as well. I was just hugely impressed with his performance.
So, I mentioned at the start of the episode that Jonas Vingegaard had a crash in training. This was first brought to a lot of people's notice not by Jonas Vingegaard, not by Visma Lisa Bike, although they did later comment on it, but by a gentleman. I said it sounded like a made-up Spaniard, Pedro García Fernández, who is a real person, I believe. And I think he's also a decent under 23 rider. Anyway, he posted, and I don't know who first saw this, but he posted on Strava, you can be a professional, but you can also be humble. Jonas falls whilst trying to drop me down the Fuente de la Reina descent, and I stop to ask him how he is, and he gets angry with me for following him down the hill. He was going fast to drop me, and he ends up on the ground. And then another gentleman who had seen some of this incident, he also wrote on Strava, I don't have this gentleman's name, you both passed me coming down, it was almost the last bend, I found Jonas by the guardrail, his face was bleeding in two places, he must have hit it hard to drag his face along the ground. It's clear he's a professional and responsible for how he goes up or down, but I also think that people like him who are professionals at high risk should be given their space and respected. So we wondered whether this was true, whether this had actually occurred. And then it was confirmed by Visma Lisebike, who also sort of confirmed that there had been an element, maybe, of Vingegaard being hassled, I suppose. They tweeted, the team tweeted, Jonas Vingegaard crashed during training on Monday. Fortunately, he's okay and did not sustain any serious injuries. In general, as a team, we would like to urge fans on bikes to always put safety first for both your own and others' well-being. Please allow riders to train and give them as much space and peace as possible. Now, chaps, I don't suppose there's not really much to litigate here, is there? I think we would all agree that everyone should behave themselves. Fans should behave themselves in these situations. You shouldn't really have your phone out and be videoing people as well. I don't know what the laws on that are in various countries, but there should be laws on in every country, really.
They're quite strict in Spain. I remember Joaquin Purito Rodriguez, when he was still pro, was actually fined by Guardia Civil a few years ago when they'd found that he'd had his phone out videoing whilst he was riding.
Because I think there was a video of this as well, wasn't it? Wasn't that? I've seen a video, and not of the crash, but of moments before the crash. So, chaps, we don't think that Vingegaard was badly hurt, although the injury sounded quite dramatic. But do either of you have anything to add on this? I mean, we sort of flippantly talked about our own experience. I mean, I think it's understandable that people get excited. I mean, this is one of the beautiful things about professional cycling, isn't it? You know, one of the best athletes in the world, they're suddenly in your midst on the road. And that is going to be exciting for a lot of people. And most riders, I think a lot of riders, will react well to fans sort of expressing their excitement. But obviously, the likes of Vingegaard, Pogacar in particular, they are going to get it constantly, to the extent where I think I'm right in saying Pogacar will sometimes, he will wear different kit in order not to be, or to evade detection by fans, not anyone else. So it's understandable that they find it a little bit vexing. Jonas Vingegaard, as we know, is also a bit of an introvert. We know that. I'm not sort of giving anything away by saying that. So he probably finds it a little bit more vexing than, say, a Pogacar or a more extroverted rider.
Certainly. I can see that happening. It's a funny one, isn't it? Again, you can see the delight in fans, and, you know, it's happened to everybody, I think, when they've first come across a superstar like that. But this is an issue as well that doesn't just go down to pros. And plenty of us have probably all had someone on a wheelie. We don't want them to be there. But obviously for professionals, if you or I go down, it's unfortunate, isn't it? But it doesn't wreck our career. For professionals, it's going to keep them away from racing. It's disappointing. You'd like to think that there's a common sense element somewhere where people just don't bother people and realise that, yeah, it's nice to see them ride past, whatever, get close, but don't get too close. For me, it's pretty much common sense. It should explain itself, but it's a bit disappointing, I guess, that it has to be explained.
It was interesting. This, I think, a few people, when they saw this, and maybe not being that familiar with the geography, they assumed that this had occurred maybe close to where the team were training, or in the area where all of the teams have been training in the last few weeks, near Calpe. But it was actually near Malaga, and I don't know exactly why Vingegaard is there at the moment, because he's not doing, so the Tour of Andalusia, which is happening in a couple of weeks or in a week or so. I think he spent time near Malaga before, and I believe he was training on his own, but it's not an area necessarily. I mean, there are cyclists around Malaga and Andalusia, but it's not an area where pro cyclists flock to.
No, I do know that Victor Campanats a few years ago did move down there. Does he still live there?
He lives in near Huelva, I think, actually.
Okay, all right. I didn't know it was that far over.
Or near Granada, right. I can't remember one of them.
Okay, because I do remember he went he went to the most Victor Campenaerts place, you know, it was a place sort of in the middle of nowhere. It was a lovely story that he was sort of investing in himself to try and get more days on the bike with the weather. But I just wonder, but if he was on his own, then that doesn't really add up either, does it?
I think the thing is, a bit like the incident with the kangaroo at the Tour Down Under, it's another reminder that professional cycling takes place on public roads. The races are closed, the roads are closed for the races, but training takes place on roads that are open to all traffic, including other cyclists. And so it is the rider's right to expect to be able to ride safely and securely, especially as they are in their working environment. You know, you wouldn't expect a professional rider to sort of just decide they're going to fly across the roundabout without stopping, or they're going to take liberties because it's their safety. And I think they have a right to expect not to be bothered. And there's, you know, different riders would have a different tolerance. Some people might not be too fussed if a couple of amateurs are sitting on the wheel, but that does get annoying, you know. If somebody you don't know is riding on your wheel, it can be irritating. So as you say, Rob, it's something where it comes down to having a bit of respect for a sort of social etiquette, really. What I would say, though, is that, you know, this is why when teams have training camps and they're riding all together, the team cars and staff will go out with them so they can ride right behind the groups and kind of keep a bit of a buffer between amateur cyclists who might fancy tagging along. If a rider's going to recon important stages of the Grand Tours, same deal. You know, they would have a team car support with them, so that gives a bit of insulation from the general public. I guess in this case, early season, just kind of regular training ride, or if somebody's training near their home, I mean, it's probably why a lot of riders choose not to train at home, and why there are little enclaves of professional cyclists in Monaco and Andorra and Girona and so on, where they can kind of work in an environment that is a little bit more used to them being there and knows how to kind of behave around them.
Do you think a disguise is a legitimate option?
Well, it worked for Alexandra Vinokourov back in the day, didn't it? The Men in Black,
when they were training in anonymous
colours, so they didn't get tested by the blood doping testers.
We have had sinister examples of this. I mean, there was a famous case, Oscar Kammensin, in 2004. He actually got stopped while he was out on a training ride by a dope tester, and he subsequently tested positive. And apparently this was a bit of a shot across the bows of everyone who was sort of doing this at the time. But we have had examples of this to do with doping, but we've had other examples as well. Marco Pantani rode in a wig, and he rode in a sort of mankini at a Gran Fondo once when he was on one of his comebacks. There's a gentleman that rides around Berlin dressed as a fox, and I've no idea why. I got a video of him the other day on Sunday. I saw him, see him around every now and again, just full fox costume.
Maybe Vingegaard could get the old white coat from his fish factory days out and ride incognito that way. I just think, you know, if you're an amateur cyclist and you see a pro and you get very excited and then an incident happens, do you want to be the person that, you know, brings down a Tour de France contender in a training ride just because you couldn't control your behaviour?
Yeah, we should say that there is no, I mean, there's a hint in this Strava post, and there's a hint in what Visma Lisebike tweeted that Vingegaard accelerated to try and get away from this gentleman. We don't know that.
No, we don't know that at all. That's true. But by the same token, you know, a professional rider is using the roads that everybody else has a right to use. So it's a tricky one, isn't it? But an unfortunate start to the year for Vingegaard, and maybe indoor training's the way forwards. They should all just do indoor training. In laboratories.
I don't do Zwift. Can you get hassled on Zwift?
You can, like, actually. Seriously? Yeah, you can. You're riding around and everyone's giving you a thumbs up. For a kind of antisocial introvert like me, you know, it can be your world's worst nightmare, because you feel like you've got to acknowledge everybody and say hello back. And just not in my nature, Daniel, as you know.
I mean, I was thinking, so at the moment, I think we've still got a few Q36.5 riders. They raised eyebrows a few weeks ago by announcing they were going to train in Chile. And this would be an interesting and positive development for me, if instead of sort of congregating in these few locations in Europe, you know, Girona is a big hub, Monaco, if we start getting much more sort of idiosyncratic choices of where to live and train, sort of riders, you know, I don't know, Enric Mas living in Stoke-on-Trent, that sort of thing.
On a cold Wednesday night?
that sort of thing, just where no one else would think to base themselves.
Daniel, you say this, but because of the importance of altitude training and because of the saturation in the hotel in Tenerife, of course, Sierra Nevada being used now, I do know that various teams are actively looking for different locations. One, because of cost, and two, because of the fact that it is almost impossible to get in hotels in those famous places at the minute.
Well, chaps, that's been a wide-ranging discussion today. Thank you both for your company. We'll be back next week for another rich cake of cycling discussion.
Maybe somebody can suggest what's the tidy of the potteries? You know, where would you train if you needed to do a big effort, a big test ahead of the Tour de France?
Promise to pass the message on to Emery. Rob will pass it on because he's from very close to where Rob lives.
Do our best.
Thank you, chaps.
Thank you. Lovely to be back with you all.
Lovely to have you back, Rob.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.